My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason. Dillis Powell and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which tests their vocabulary. For 2 marks, what's the meaning of the following words? We begin with Frank Muir this week. Frank, yours is incunabula, or if you prefer it, you can call it incunables.
Sounds like a bone in the lower part of the leg, doesn't it? It isn't. It used to be called 15ers.
Yes.
In fact. And it, printing, modern printing, was begun round about 1440 by Herr Gutenberg. And printing, which was printed between 1440 and 1501, has a special quality to collectors. And this was called incunabula.
Yeah.
The books and the sheets printed between them, which is the nursery of printing.
Absolutely right. It comes from a Latin word, curiously, meaning swaddling clothes, things you wear in the cradle. 2 marks, Frank. And now, Anne Scott James, your word is couvade, C-O-U-V-A-D-E, and in spite of my pronunciation, you'll perhaps recognize it's French in origin, couvade.
Well, when you go into a restaurant and you have a rather nice cheap French meal for about £2 a head, very good, and then there's a couvade on top for about another £2, that I'd take to be the meaning of the word.
No, you'd have to send for a gynecologist or obstetrician.
It's when the husband of a woman in childbirth has a sort of hysterical childbirth too and goes to bed at the same time.
That's right. Separately?
I decline to answer that.
This is a curious...
Depends whether you're in a private or a public ward.
Yes, that's right, isn't it? It's a curious custom among some primitive peoples where the husband pretends to be ill and goes almost to the point of having birth pangs himself, and so he's put to bed during his wife's accouchement and has certain restrictions placed on his diet and his other activities as well. And it comes from a French word meaning to hatch. Dennis Norton, your turn. To absquatulate. A-B-S-Q-U-A-T-U-L-A-T-E, absquatulate.
Well, it's a rather, one of those old-fashioned, rather heavy-handedly humorous words for to hop it or to make your leave or something. Yeah, I don't know if anybody remembers a radio act, double act, called Alexander and Moe's. Yes. And they always used to finish by saying, well, boy, I think we should absquatulate now. And then I think it always used to come in those kind of humorous articles or books where Americans were always named Hiram P. somebody or other. And they use the word absquatulate.
I think the government's trying to bring on bills in reference to housing to absquatulate people.
Yes, that's right.
I think that was probably, actually, it was one of those almost schoolboyish made-up words because it does sort of divide up into that. You've got ab away from squat, sit.
Yes, it's this sort of very facetious thing. You take an ordinary word like squat, you put a Latin prefix and a Latin suffix onto it, and it's quite early. It comes first, I think, in 1830. But to abscond, to decamp, to go and squat somewhere else. 2 marks. And now, Dennis Powell, and your word is jobation. J-O-B-A-T-I-O-N, jobation.
Jobation? Having a job, I should
have
thought.
No, Joe, that's why I said it isn't jobation, it's jobation.
Well, it's been rather wretched then. He was covered with boils, poor Job was.
Yes, this is not a physical ailment, though he probably felt pretty miserable. In fact, he felt pretty miserable throughout the whole of the Book of Job.
He did, didn't he? Yes, he had a lot of comforters.
Yes, and what did they do?
Well, they didn't really comfort. They sympathised falsely and made him feel much more wretched.
Yes, I think they were trying to help, but they were appalling.
They were enjoying it. They were enjoying
appalling, it. Prosy old bores, that's what they were, really.
Yes.
Well, that's right. Jobation means a prolonged, tedious reproof, a sort of rocket which goes on and on forever. And it is because what were called Job's comforters, who were supposed to be his three best friends, did him no kind of good at all. Yes, I did give a little help there, just so 1.5 out of 2. Before we go on to the next round, here are the quotations you've been given for the last round of all, and Frank, yours is, a pun is the lowest form of wit, and yours, Dennis, Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled pepper. Well, now we have a round of poetical pairings, and for 2 marks, can you recite the lines of poetry from which the following two-word quotation has been extracted? Frank Muir, yours is, unofficial rose.
Oh, Peter Brook. Rupert Brooke.
Yes?
Yes, it's the old vicarage, isn't it? Gloucester.
Absolutely right, but can you put it in its settings in a couple of lines?
Unkempt.
Yes.
About these hedgerows, blows. An English unofficial rose.
Well done. Absolutely dead right. Anne Scott James, yours next. Your 2 words are double sway. S-W-A-Y. Double sway.
Help. Help.
Oh, I don't know.
Any clues coming?
It's a difficult one. I'll give you the lines, 2 lines previously, which might help. I won't guarantee it. At church, with meek and unaffected grace, his looks adorned that venerable place.
Goldsmith.
Oh, of course, Oliver Goldsmith.
And the poem? You ought to get this now.
Oh, yes, The Village, The Deserted Village.
Yes. This is the parson in the village of Auburn, which is the deserted village in Goldsmith's poem. Truth from his lips prevailed with double sway, and fools who came to scoff
remained
to pray.
Not easy. No.
Not easy at all. 1.5. Dennis Norden, Little Life.
Little life is round. Yes, that's our little life is rounded with a sleep.
Yes, and from?
That's Prospero's speech where he says, our revels now are ended.
Quite
well. Well done.
Mm-hmm. And we are such stuff that dream, as dreams are made on, mm-hmm. not of.
And our little life is rounded,
rounded with a sleep.
Quite right. Shakespeare, The Tempest, Prospero's. Prospero's great speech while the scenery of the masque dissolves round the back of the stage and speaking to Miranda, among others. 2 marks. And Dillis Powell, yours is Runcible Spoon.
Runcible Spoon? Not yet, didn't it? my very learned partner says it's Edward Lear.
Yes. Can you...
honey, isn't it? Yes, The Owl and the Pussycat.
Lear, The Owl and the Pussycat, they dined on mince and slices of quince, which they ate with a runcible spoon, and hand in hand on the edge of the sand, they danced by the light of the moon. 2 marks. Well, now a quick round for Lonely Hearts. Now, I asked the teams last week to bring along for us their own favourite line or favourite passage culled from the pages of romantic literature. And we begin with Frank Muir this time.
I think one of the loveliest lines that I know, romantic lines, it was by Sheridan, although it's attributed to him, but I still think he could have said it, where he said to a young girl, won't you come into the garden? I'd like my roses to see you.
Well, now it's Anne Scott James's turn. Anne?
I I'd like just to give two lines, which it's, I'm so sentimental about Greece, always, and they just always make me cry or want to cry whenever I hear them, which is Byron's, the mountains look on Marathon, and Marathon looks on the sea.
And from?
Don Juan.
Yep. Thank you very much. And now, Dennis Norden.
Well, I found two very short ones. One from a poet who Frank often mentions, called John Byrom, not Byron, in the 18th century, wrote a poem called Colin and Phoebe for the Spectator, in which he said, "My fair one is gone, and my joys are all drowned, and my heart, I am sure, weighs more than a pound." And the other one is one that I read many years ago, and I thought it was one of the most romantic four lines I ever heard. I still think it's pretty good, and it's a nice example of sort of good, bad writing, and it's a love poem where the chap says, "Come dally me, my darling, dally me with kisses, loiter me with lingers while the Rome's all burn."
Lovely. Thank you very much, Dennis. And now, Dennis Bauer.
Mine is really rather romantic. I found it a long, long time ago in an anthology of, I think, English madrigal verse. I no longer have my book, but I learnt it by heart because I liked it so much. And it says, "See, see what I have for my darling, a robin redbreast and a starling. These I give both in hopes to move thee. And yet, thou sayst, I do not love thee."
Charming, pathetic. On this occasion, the chairman was allowed a quotation from romantic literature.
Good, good.
Which I'll give you. "There were never two so cut out for one another. We both love singing, dancing, treats, and music. We sit and talk and wrangle and are friends. When we are together, we never hold our tongues, and then we always have a noise of fiddles at our heels. He hunts me as merrily as the hounds does the hare, and either this is love or I know it not." It's Dryden in a play called Secret Love.
Yes. Lovely.
Well, we now come to the last round, and to Frank and Dennis's quotations, and the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. Frank's quotation was, "A pun is the lowest form of wit." Frank.
What an awful thing to be said to you at the end of 22 years of this stuff, isn't it? And it was said to me by our local master baker, Mr. Huskisson, who's got a bakery in Lime Lane. We've been living in our house now for 25 years, and I'm trying to plan a little party for locals in Thorpe, who've also lived there 25 years, and I thought we should have it as it was 25 years ago. You know, the chaps should wear sock suspenders and pocket watches in the top pocket with a kind of thong which fastened to the buttonhole, and the ladies should wear hats and artificial flowers and California poppy scent. And I thought for tea we must have Chelsea buns. And I went to Mr. Huskisson and said, "Could I have some Chelsea buns, please?" He said, "That sort of baking is not in my curricula." He said, "It does not figure in my modus operandum of the master bakery of Lime Lane." He said, He said, "I'll tell you what, Mr. Muir," he said, "I've heard your program, my word, for some years now, and," he said, "if you can make me laugh," he said, "then I will manufacture that particular article which you requested," he said, "because after all, one good turn deserves another." So I went away and thought, right, fine, yes, I'll make him laugh by doing a my word twist on "one good turn deserves another," you see. So I rushed back and said, took me about a day to work this one out, you know, and I said, "Mr. Huskisson, did you see that report that there was a kind of auction in Virginia Water, where everybody auctions off rubbish they don't want. And in the local paper, I said, did you see that thing? That there was a tea urn, which was all about 1812 or something, and it was put up for auction, and nobody bid at all. I said, is that right, Mr. Huskisson? Surely one good urn deserves an offer. Nothing. So I rushed away again, and I came back and showed him my pullover, and I said, I've got an actor friend called Arthur Howard who loves hand craftsmanship. He loves the way people sew, and he really appreciates it. And look, I burnt my pullover with some tobacco from my pipe, and my wife's done a little darn on it. And I think I should give this pullover to Arthur, don't you? Because one good darn deserves an Arthur. His face was impassive. So I went back the following day and I said, did you go to that young conservative wine tasting party? He said, I did not have the pleasure. I could not vouchsafe that kind of time. I am busy baking. And I said, I went. It was rather interesting because the chap next to me was tasting all the wine, but he had a vintage card. You know, he had a sort of wine card with all the vintages on, which told him which were the good years. And he was saying, yes, that's a very good year. And he said, I took the card and I tore it up and threw it away. I said, and he was, as he was nipping the wine, he didn't know one from the other. I said, it just shows you that wine card torn deceives a niffer. Nothing. I said, Mr. Huskinson, won't you please, I realised I was on the wrong tack, you know, with that kind of thing. I said, Mr. Huskinson, won't you please bake us one dozen Chelsea buns? He said, that I will not do. I will not do, sir. Form a question of philosophy. I said, never mind that, sir. Think, Mr. Huskisson, think of the importance of buns through history, through literature. I mean, Shakespeare, Hamlet, get thee to a bunnery. When you think of plays like Victorian melodramas, Maria Martin, or The Mystery of the Red Bun, you know, or the films of Africa, of lions being brought up on that delectable substance, bun-free. I said, won't you reconsider? He said, Mr. Muir, may I be outspoken? He said, I do not relish plays on words. I do not think that they behove you. He said, they are at the lowest part of the fulcrum of humour. He said, it is not analogous, he said, to my trade, because I start with ears of wheat, as you start with the vocabulary of the English language. He said, it's ground into flour, to you it makes words. I might bake a batch of cottage loaves, or you might make a novel. He said, but don't waste this precious substance. He said, I will not make buns, because it's just a dollop of dough, Mr. Muir. And he said, I would ask you to bear in mind in your trade what the old saying that we master bakers have, a bun is the lowest form of wheat.
I do hope Frank got his party after all. And we go on to Dennis, and his line was, if I can get it, Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled pepper. From Peter Piper's practical principles of plain and perfect pronunciation. Dennis?
Well, sometime towards the end of last year, the night porter of a well-known London hotel sent me a rather unusual cassette tape that he'd recorded. And it went something like this. Hello, testing. Hello, Mr. Norden. Having listened to your program, I realize how badly you need an interesting story. I think, actually, he must have been related to Mr. Huskisson from The Void. He said, so, realizing you need an interesting story, let me explain that being the night porter of a big hotel of this large size, I do have the opportunity of observing many strange and pathetic human dramas especially as I also do a lot of peeping through keyholes. But the strangest tale whatever unfolded was last December, when an eccentric millionaire arrived here to occupy our most expensive accommodation, the Crippen's Suite. He was a small little man with a military bearing, which he tossed from hand to hand while he spoke to you. And the first thing he did was hand me a bunch of fibres and instruct me to purchase him a pair of night vision binoculars. And it was when I returned with them that he disclosed to me his bizarre plan. Apparently, for all his wealth, he only had 1 month to live. At the end of that time, his wife was coming back from her mother's. But he said, what I'd like to do during this period of freedom is use my money to benefit a victim of the affluent society. Have you ever known what it's like, he said, to be without in the midst of plenty? Well, as it happened, I had, because I once worked as a caretaker in a girls' school. Well, when I nodded, he said, what I'm going to do is scan the nighttime streets through this pair of binoculars till I spot someone in real need. Some poor, poverty-stricken, starving, down-and-out pauper with no job, no money, no home, no prospects. Then I'm going to give him the greatest New Year's Eve he's ever had in his life, because for that one night, he will not only be given the finest dinner that money can buy, not only the finest wines in your cellar, not only the use of this luxurious suite with its marble bathroom and its satin bedsheets, but also the companionship of the most beautiful girl in the whole of this cold-hearted city. Well, Mr. Norden, to say I was flabbergasted would be understating. I was so taken aback, I very nearly gave him the right change. But sure enough, night after night, he stood gazing down from that window till finally, at 7 o'clock on the evening of December the 31st, my buzzer went. But when I went up to his room an hour later, he was in high excitement. That's him, he said, pointing down from out the window. Down there, him curled up asleep in that litter bin. I looked down and I saw, well, how can I describe him? Filthy, unshaved, bleary-eyed, ragged, unkempt, unwashed. And those were his attractive aspects. Right, said this millionaire. The rest is up to you. While I depart for one of my opulent chateaus in the Doi Dong, I want you to fetch him up here and see that he is given the pick of the most expensive items in your kitchen. Oysters, lobster, pheasant, champagne, even a cup of coffee. Then, at 15 minutes after midnight, this young lady, known to the select few as Miss Earth Shatterer of 1937, she will knock at this door, and when she departs in the morning, you will present her with this large sack full of Swiss francs. Well, Mr. Norden, knowing that you have to keep these stories of yours down to a certain level of long-windedness, I will skip the details of how I collected that strong-smelling person from down in the litter bin and fulfilled all the details of the rich man's behest. What I must mention, though, is that by some strange twirp of fate, our world-renowned French wine waiter, Monsieur Mohamed Patel, he wrote down the wrong order for this chap. Instead of serving Chummy 4 bottles of the 47, he trundled in 47 bottles of the 4. Consequence was that at 10 minutes after midnight, when I was making my customary round of hotel keyholes, what do I see through the aperture of the Crippen suite? There is Mr. Unsavory, lying sprawled across the Charlotte Russe, dead to the world. I realized immediately what had happened. Him being in a starving state, him and the old year had passed out round about the same time. So what's the first thing that immediately comes into my mind? Well, obviously, that when that exquisite bit of gift wrapping comes tapping at his door in less than 5 minutes from now,
The only thing that she's likely to get in the way of entertainment is the Scottish dancing on BBC Two. Right? Well, Mr. Norton, if there's one thing in this world that I hate, it is waste. That really goes against the groin. So, in less time than it takes to tell, I had opened that door with my master key, bundled our friend there down the laundry chute, whipped off my porter's jacket, slipped on a silk dressing gown, and had two glasses of champers poured out ready. Mr. Norden, in expressing the doubt that you will ever have one-tenth as happy a New Year as I had that night, I just hope you can put to some use this strange tale of how an eyeballing hotel servant availed himself of one of the perquisites meant for an inebriated indigent. Or to put that whole thing in one line, peeping porter nicked a perk of pickled pauper.
By your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the story, but the overall result of this week's contest is a draw.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott-James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Schreiner.